Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Prolific Chico author Douglas Keister is considered one of America's most noted photographers of historic architecture. His work includes 6 books on cemetery architecture, 4 books on vintage trailers, an award-winning bilingual children's book, and 4 novels. Later in the hour, I will be asking him about his latest novel, The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, a Chick Corbett yarn. But first, Douglas Keister's newest book of architecture is co-authored with Harold Gellner, a practicing architect and longtime syndicated columnist. Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s, is a coffee table book of fanciful architecture, which features 5 homes in Chico. Douglas Keister, welcome.
Always good to be here.
Well, I'm so happy that you dedicated your book to me.
Yeah, I did. How nice of me.
Well, not just me, but to whom did you dedicate your book? I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
I dedicated it to everybody. No, well, I dedicated it to whimsy, people with whimsy.
I mean,
it's kind of a big blanket of dedication.
You said you dedicate this book to all those who embrace and incorporate whimsy into their lives.
Right. A whole lot of people.
Well,
the people I tend to like to hang around with.
Yeah, they're fun.
Yeah, they are.
Well, I was curious as to how you got the idea for a book like this.
Well, I used to live in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and one of my good friends was Errol Gellner, who had an architecture column and was a practicing architect. And we always said, we got to do a book together someday. We just didn't quite know.
Because you both have this interest in architecture.
Yes. Well, I had done a bunch of books on bungalows and what are called the painted ladies' books on Victorians. And Errol is a great writer. And also a great guy, and a great friend. And we just said, we got to do something together. And we just didn't quite know what it was. But back then, I had a little bit of pull with, you know, in the New York publishing world. And Errol had written this article about some kind of whimsical architecture that was in Berkeley. And I said, you know, maybe I can convince my publisher that there should be a book about that. And we didn't even know what the history, the root of it was. But I convinced my publisher to do this book. And he actually said, well, you got to write an article first. You got to do something. So Errol wrote an article about it. And in the process of him researching and writing the article, for the newspaper, we were trying to ask people about, we were looking for a specific type of architecture. And we said, well, it's kind of like Hansel and Gretel stuff, kind of fairy tale, kind of. We couldn't think of a good name. And then one of us said, we're giving us joint, you know, authorship of this. We said jointly. We said, you know, like a storybook. And then we said, oh, that's it, storybook style. And really, we did not realize at the time that it really was a style of architecture that nobody had ever given a name to. And it only existed, you know, formally for about 10 years. And so in the process of doing the book, we wound up researching and figuring out where it all came from. And the original book came out in 2001, and it was the first time anybody had ever done a book on it. But, it had some gaps. And the publisher sold all the books and then decided, well, we're not going to do it anymore. And then a few years ago, I convinced a new publisher to redo the book with a lot more stuff, because we had a lot more information, too, about where it all came from. And it's a fascinating story that's never been told.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and we're talking about his latest architecture book, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And I did jot down that you described it as Hansel and Gretel. And yeah. I did jot that down because, yeah, that's a way of describing it. Because we, as people are listening to you right now, can't see these beautiful color photographs. Yeah. And so we have to describe in words what the photographs are like in your book. So I think Hansel and Gretel can help.
You think about a Grimm's fairy tale, you know, a children's book or something like that. The houses with the swayback roofs and they're just fanciful, you know, and they're very, very, very old, you know, European, very old European.
With the exception of Neuschwanstein.
That
Walt Disney said, that looks like a real castle.
Right, right. Well, Walt Disney was an ambulance driver at the end of World War I. A lot of people don't know that. He actually showed up as the war ended, but he stayed in Europe for quite a while. You know, he still needed ambulances. And he saw or heard about a castle in Bavaria called Neuschwanstein. And he saw that. And later on, when he built Sleeping Beauty Castle, he modeled it on Neuschwanstein. But Neuschwanstein was built in the middle of the 19th century by, this is Errol's language, it's wonderful, intermittently lucid King Ludwig.
Oh, that's a complimentary way to say it, rather than
that's
yes.
That's a very, very good
and
description.
Saying crazy.
Yeah, a kind way of saying crazy. But it was actually, when it was built in the middle of the 19th century, it was actually built to mimic an old style of architecture. So it wasn't like, although of course it was a new castle, but it was built to look old. So that is a hallmark of storybook style. It is houses that are built to look old.
So. You know, what you just said about Walt Disney driving an ambulance at the end of World War I that not many people know. In fact, you have a treasure trove of little facts that not many people know, and I'm sure it comes in handy because I didn't say so in your introduction, but you participate in trivia.
Yes, I do. I'm a sleuth. I mean, you know, I get something. I got to figure it out. And luckily, you know, my co-author, Errol, is the same way. We have to figure this out. Where did this come from? And storybook style, I think, is especially good for that because it's not a formal architecture style, you know, like Greek Revival or Art Deco or, you know, arts and crafts. It's this kind of weird style of architecture. So to figure that all out and you know, to kind of think about, well, this has got to happen and this has got to happen, and to have all those pieces of the puzzle just kind of fall into place, it was like, oh, we're right. it started right after World War I in Hollywood. And there was one particular man, Harry Oliver, who built this house for a movie set. And that was like the first storybook style house ever. And it was built for this movie called Face of the World. And it looks like something out of Germany or Bavaria or something like that. Very, very, very fairy tale-ish. And what's really, really interesting is that that house, which was moved just a few years later, still in the 1920s, to Beverly Hills, still exists today. And that's extremely unusual for the first of anything to still be around. It doesn't quite fit into Beverly Hills really well, but there it is in Beverly Hills.
And you have a photograph of this house, which
yes.
brings me to my question. Doug, I looked everywhere in your book for credit for the photographs. These photographs are spectacular, and I could not find any credit for the photographs.
Well, they're all mine.
I think you should give yourself credit.
Well, I'm on the cover of the book, you know.
Well, yes, and I did introduce you as a photographer,
right.
But I think you ought to say the photographs in this book are by Douglas Keister.
Yeah. Well, there are some archival photographs.
And that's what I assume, too.
Yes, yeah. And we, of course, put credits there. What's one of the big differences from the original book to the new book, I stumbled on, actually, a guy named Mark Wanamaker in Los Angeles, who's like the king of historic Los Angeles photographs, and he generously let us use a whole bunch of them, like the construction of that house I'm talking about, which, by the way, is called the Witch's House, mm-hmm. Sometimes called the Spadina House, too.
Well, with all the beautiful photographs to choose from, I wondered how you happened to choose the one that you did for your cover, because it is beautiful, but there are a lot of beautiful ones. And I have my own ideas about why this one was chosen, but I'd like to hear your reasons.
Well, there are some very practical reasons, which kind of take a little bit of the gusto out of it. But it runs really well vertically for the cover. So, and it's, you know, it's got a fair amount of sky, but also it is...
So a nice blue sky in the background.
It's got a nice blue sky, but it's got a wave roof, which is this, you know...
Very characteristic of these kinds of houses.
And it's got a turret. And also one of the hallmarks of storybook style is that these houses don't have porches, like we consider porches. A little tiny, tiny porch. I mean, just maybe a little thing over it, and that's it has that. And it is located, although we say it in the captions in the book, it's located probably about 10 or 12 blocks from the original Disney studio in the Los Feliz area of Los Angeles. So it's kind of got it all. It's got, and it's a stucco, which is what storybooks should be. And it, you know, it's whimsical. There are very few straight lines. Because storybook style, if you start putting straight lines, it doesn't look old. I mean, as anybody that's old knows, gravity, you know, takes hold, and that's one of the hallmarks of it, is artificial aging and the effects of gravity. And so that's what this house is. And it's little tiny house.
Well, and I'll tell you then a couple of things that I thought maybe went into the choice of it. It is a little house, but you also make the point that architects often create almost an optical illusion to make the house look bigger,
right.
by the scale. But it has the turret. You mentioned the roof, and that is very characteristic of this style. The houses in development, at least one of them has to have a turret. But also, I thought another reason you may have chosen it is that a lot of these houses are on a small lot.
Right.
And this house is located far enough back that you've got this lovely kind of stone walkway leading up to it.
Kind of a serpentine,
nice. So I thought maybe that was one reason.
Yes, that's true. It's kind of got it all. And that, if you have any, like if you had a regular straight sidewalk, it wouldn't be right. You know, you want it to curve, and you want voids in the sidewalk where the grass is growing up. So it just looks old. And they're adorable, these houses. If these houses don't make you smile when you see them, there's something wrong with you.
My guest is author and photographer Douglas Keister. His newest architecture book is Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And I mentioned this beautiful house on the front cover. And then I turn over on the back of your book, and here it says, Homes of the Moment in Eastwood Park, Chico, California.
Yeah, it's great.
And on this flyer, I guess it is, the phone number has two digits,
yeah, right.
98. So that gives us a clue right there that it's quite old. And I didn't recognize the house on the cover, I don't think.
No, because it was never built.
Aha.
A number of houses in the flyer have been built, and also they still exist in Chico. And that's another great thing about Chico, the houses in Chico, it's one of the largest intact storybook style enclaves in America. And I know these things because I've been everywhere. And it was built, this tract was built in the late 1920s, which fits right into our 10-year time period by a guy named Orville Tracy. Who's,
I thought that was curious. His name, his first name is Orville.
Yeah, it's Orville, but it's close enough. O.E.
Yeah.
Tracy. And his son, Bud Tracy, is still a realtor in Orville. And it was this little tract called Eastwood Park, kind of centered, you might say, around 9th and Cypress, and you know, a few blocks around there, over 100 homes with various degrees of storybook elements. And it was built to appeal to a little bit, not really upper crust, but the doctors and the university professors, because these little houses cost more. Even though they look very diminutive, they cost more because of all those curves and all that, the special effects, the artificial aging. So they cost more. And then, of course, when the Depression hit, it all stopped because nobody had any money anymore.
Well, years ago when I moved to Chico, and you can't help but notice these houses. They are so eye-catching.
Yeah.
And as you ride down the street and you see these houses, you think, what's the story behind these houses?
I thank the Chico Historical Society, John Gallardo, a guy named Alan Tokerman, who had this original brochure that is on the back of the book, really contribute to this, to contribute to the story. I also like to point out anybody that lives in Chico that's gone up 9th Street on the way to the freeway notices this one house with a wave roof, a wave shingle roof. It's not in the book. And people go, why isn't that in the book? Well, I said, because the lines of it are straight and it's not right. And so, and I'm...
So it didn't make the cut.
It did not make the cut. I'm the arbiter of of storybook style. And it, somebody at some point has looks like they put in, you know, vinyl siding or something like that on it. But it can be saved.
My guest is Douglas Keister. His newest architecture book is the Storybook Style and the America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And you have kind of taken a theatrical motif, if I want to call it that, in naming your chapters. You have chapters, the opening act, now playing nationwide, ensembles, encores.
Right.
So
yeah.
These are some of your chapter names that you carry out this theatrical motif.
Yeah, it just fits so well into it because when they were started, the reason these homes got started in Los Angeles because the period film was all the rage. And so the boys, when they came home from World War I, they had these, they remember what they saw, especially in France. And when they were hired as set designers, they, you know, kind of took that knowledge and things that they'd seen. And then when they started moonlighting as builders, they applied those things they'd seen in Europe to this style of architecture, including Hollywoodland.
Yes, and one of your chapters is called Hollywoodland.
Right.
And people say, Hollywoodland?
Right.
What's that about?
Yeah, that was this developer in the mid-1920s, really, that there was this tract of land, and there were two men, and they developed it, and they built this big sign, and it said Hollywoodland on it. And it was originally intended to be what they called at the time Romantic Revival Homes. And there was just brochures about it. And a number of them were built. Matter of fact, in the book, I have Humphrey Bogart's old house and Gloria Swanson's house. And the Humphrey Bogart's old house, when I photographed it, was owned by Dean of Jan and Dean, Ephron Symbolist Sr.'s house. Which when I photographed it had just been sold by a guy named Moby, a musician. But people don't realize that sign originally said Hollywood Land, and it was all supposed to be that kind of style. But, of course, once again, by 1930 or 1929, when the Depression happened, the money ran out, and just all sorts of houses got built there rather than just storybook.
Well, you have a photograph when the sign did say Hollywood Land. And there are some dignitaries in this black and white photograph.
Right.
They're all dressed in their suits and their hats, and they have some mules.
Yeah, pulling the plow.
Pulling a plow up on this hill with this Hollywoodland developer. And you couldn't take this picture today because the land came off the Hollywoodland sign.
Right,
and what was the story of that? Why did they do that?
The sign in general deteriorated, and they were going to tear it all down. And then the Chamber of Commerce basically said, well, let's figure out a way to save this. We'll take the land part off. So it was just, you know, less maintenance because it was just easier to do it that way. And, you know, and even as soon, you know, I think 25, 30 years ago, it really got deteriorated, but then people adopted letters and you know, sponsored letters to keep it going. And of course, now it's a worldwide
It's a landmark.
It's a landmark. and but people don't know it was an advertisement for what are now called storybook style homes.
So he was going to develop this. So Hollywoodland was established in 1923.
Right.
So that again fits into this time slot that you have designated. And I think we've pretty much covered what you call your chapter one is the backstory.
Right.
And is there anything else you want to add? Because There, you have a photograph of this rather exotic-looking Oriental Eastern.
Right, Brighton, yeah, Brighton Pavilion. One of the things about storybook style, it took its cues, you might say, to this whole thing of back in the 19th century. There was this rapid industrialization, and people were looking to recapture, you know, part of the handmade things and things that were more natural looking. The whole arts and crafts movement developed from that. And even Marie Antoinette, you know, she, you know, we don't think of her, we think of her as a very formal sort of person, but she wanted to, you know, hearken back to her childhood. So she had her architect build a little village in a corner of Versailles, and it's still there today. And I got permission to photograph that inside and out when I was in Versailles. So there, it's the storybook style is this whole thing of kind of getting back to more natural ways of seeing things, the picturesque landscape movement. And it's, there are some people now and then that do build storybook style homes. They're very expensive to build because the craftspeople that can do that kind of thing just don't exist anymore. So they kind of have to reinvent all of these techniques. But there is a chapter called Encores in the book where I feature some more modern interpretations of storybook style. I mean, in Carmel and Louisville, Kentucky. In Texas, they are here and there. The best one is in a place called Olalla, Washington, appropriately enough.
I noticed that name in your book.
We also have in the book, I think in the first chapter, you know, we kind of have the whole story of how it all evolved. And also, you know, it's a little bit of a distraction, but you know, from the first book in 2001 that came out, till now, now that storybook style, people know what it is. I was contacted by many, many people, and so I took new pictures of houses, and people finally realize what they have. Before, they didn't even know what they had. So there's been this really kind of a renaissance, you might say, of storybook style houses, and hopefully, in a place like here in Chico, people will really appreciate what they have, what we have here, what a resource we have. I mean, there is. Really, I say it's one of the most intact enclaves in the country, but I would say it is the most intact enclave in the entire country. And it's amazing it's in Chico rather than Los Angeles. So we have a real resource here that hopefully people will embrace.
My guest is Douglas Keister. He is a writer and photographer, and his latest book is Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. He is co-author of this book. And when I think of this style of architecture, I think of Gaudí.
Yes.
And his very natural, organic kind of architecture. And it's such a contrast to this picture you have in your book of arabesque, even.
Right, but that's all part of that. It's all this it's whimsy. You look at that picture, of course, when you can't see on the radio, it's whimsy. It makes you smile. And as a matter of fact, of course, in the book, we have photographs I took in Barcelona of Gaudí's architecture. So it's all part of the story. And the last picture in the introduction, I have Art Deco architecture just to show you what happened. And it is very angular, very upright. And it's then you can really see the contrast between storybook and streamline architecture and Art Deco architecture, kind of what happened. So if you read the book and you look at the captions and look at the houses, you'll be able to pick out storybook style architecture or places that are what I call a nod to storybook style. They may not be full on, but they have elements of it, and we have some wonderful ones here in Chico.
Well, if people do want to see these Chico houses, you've kind of mentioned where they are located. Could you describe so they'll, because there's one that's kind of obvious. It has the characteristic turret. It also has these little slits of windows that I always look at when I'm in Europe and I see castles. They have these little very narrow windows. And people might think, oh, that's just some kind of architectural feature there. But it really, in the original castles and fortresses, right, right, they served a purpose. So describe what that Chico house with the turret has.
That's on Eastwood Street. And there are two of them, one on either end of the street, and they're mirror images of each other. You look really close. They were one is brick and one is stucco. And sometimes some of these things are dovecotes or dovecotes, where they would have doves, raise them for eating, and others so archers, you know, could defend the castle. So they have this very narrow slit, and they can just narrow enough to put their bow and to see through there.
But the enemy could not hit that tiny little slot.
Right.
It would be very hard to do, yeah, whereas the person inside protecting himself could aim his bow.
And most people, when they see the house on Eastwood Street, the one that's kind of pinkish, kind of peachy, mm-hmm, colored, not peachy colored, it looks like it's just one house. It was actually a duplex.
That surprised me, too. And then I looked more closely and I could see, oh, it does have another door over there on the side.
Yeah. No, actually, there's a door. There are two doors in the turret. You can't even see them.
Yeah. You know what else I appreciate about these houses? My house was built much later than this, and it has the biggest feature in the front of my house is the garage.
Right.
It's very practical, and I'm glad I have that garage, but these houses look so much better, and how did they pull that off?
There's an alley, and one of the things you see in Chico a lot are alleys. And so in Eastwood Park, there are alleys, and so you access where the garages are. So the streetscape has great curb appeal because there's... And you don't see a lot of cars on the street because they're in the back. So the streetscape is just beautiful without all those nasty-looking garages.
That's true. Well, what about some of the other houses? You have a picture of a house, a brick with a turret.
Right, and that's the mirror image of the other one. You don't really recognize it immediately.
Because they look so different. Material.
But you look, if you compare it to the other one, they're exact mirror images. And that one still is a duplex. The other one has been converted into a single family home. There are a lot of houses on 8th Street, and a lot of those have cat slide roofs, and that is that roof that kind of curves around. And other features that you'll see in some of the Chico houses are rolled eaves, where the shingles roll around, and that is to mimic thatch. And very expensive to build that, but that's it's an artificial it's a little feature to it just makes it more fun, but it's more expensive to build, obviously. So the artificial aging with the cat slide roofs, the tiny little porches, Errol, I'd say that you'll kind of know one when you see it because it's whimsical. It has you can't define whimsy, but you know it when you see it.
Well, I think people now who live in Chico or live outside Chico, it's worth a trip, I think, to just ride down these neighborhoods in Chico that you have described and pick out these whimsical homes.
Right. Oh, people love them. People absolutely love them.
Well, Doug, you have written another book. So this book, again, I'll remind people the name of this book we've just been talking about, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And he wrote that with a co-author. We're going to take a break. And after the break, we're going to visit a famous cemetery with the characters of your book, Douglas Keister's latest novel, The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, A Chick Corbett Yarn. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Chico author Douglas Keister, who has written 6 books on cemetery architecture and 4 novels. And there's a photograph of a cemetery on the cover of his latest novel, The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, a Chick Corbett yarn. Douglas Keister, welcome back.
Here I am again.
And I thought it was interesting that you have kind of combined some of your expertise in cemetery architecture and history with this new novel that you have written.
Well, you know, one of the things you learn as a writer, or you hear a lot about, is write what you know. So I know cemeteries. And so I've written almost all of my novels have cemeteries somewhere in them. And this one I just went full on, you know, the Sleepy Hollow Mystery.
Including the cover photograph.
Yes. And I'll tell the readers here that, the listeners and the readers eventually, hopefully, this photograph is actually the Chico Cemetery.
Well, because I was going to say, I looked and looked and looked for, well, who took the cover photograph? And I thought, well, it's logical that a photographer would take the cover photograph. And yet, when I look on the first page, I see it's by Jim Logan.
But it's not exactly. If you read it really closely, it says Headless Horseman Photograph by Jim Logan. And Jim Logan's a friend of mine. He is actually the superintendent of Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in New York. And I knew I had to have a picture of the Headless Horseman on the cover. And he had taken this one that he sent me, but I wanted to make it at night. So I photoshopped it with a photograph.
I figured you had to do that.
I did, yeah.
But I did not recognize the Chico Cemetery in the background behind this Headless Horseman.
Right, and that's the fireman's plot at the Chico Cemetery, because I give, every year I give a nighttime tour of the Chico Cemetery.
At Halloween.
At Halloween, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the fact that this Headless Horseman is on here, that there is a photograph, I mean, it's a real horse, you know, it's not an illustration, it's a real horse. So it made me wonder, in the book, they mentioned that the church, where the Sleepy Hollow, the Dutch church, hires a headless horseman.
Right.
And so I was wondering if this is actually a photograph of the guy that's hired to ride a white horse through the cemetery.
It is. Yes, it is. The old people get confused. You have Sleepy Hollow Cemetery and the old Dutch churchyard, mm-hmm. and they are right next to each other, so you can't really, there's no big border between them. But the old Dutch church, they hire this guy that poses as the Headless Horseman now and then for, you know, mostly around the Halloween time and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But Sleepy Hollow Cemetery also hires him sometimes when they're doing photography workshops. They do, although Sleepy Hollow is an active cemetery, they really capitalize on their, you know, their famous, that they're a famous place. So they do a lot of nighttime tours. They do a lot of just tours in general. They get photo workshops. And they really, it's a way to supplement their income. So they do hire him now and then.
In fact, when I was reading your characters in your book, talk about this photography workshop. And so I figured that was true. There are a lot of things in here that are factual. I mean, it's a novel, but I figured, okay, that sounds like that really exists.
Yes.
And they really hire a guy to ride this white horse to, like you say, probably it's Halloween because I see he's got a pumpkin there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they milk it. They milk it for all it's worth.
Well, I would think so.
Yeah, they do.
And this novel, as I'm reading it, in a lot of ways doesn't fit a mold like most mystery novels. And could you describe in what way yours is different from other mystery novels?
Well, I think part of it is that, well, I incorporate a lot of stuff that's true. It's part of it's like a guidebook to Sleepy Hollow. And I really don't want to be influenced by somebody else. So I just kind of come up with some idea in a very, very vague sort of way. And I tell a story. People wonder, do I have this outline? Do I have this little script? No. I just start writing. And whatever happens, happens. And then then I have, you know, I have people that will tell me that, well, I don't understand this or something like that, and I'll incorporate things in there. But I don't know. I really can't explain it because I don't want to denigrate myself, but but I'm not a writer with a capital W. I'm a storyteller. So I think my novels read like, you know, you're sitting around the campfire with somebody and they're spinning this tale. And they use just enough stuff that's true so you can relate to it. And then you weave in some eccentric characters, and I just run with it. I don't really have a real explanation, except people do say they're very readable. They're kind of like a Spielberg movie. There's not a lot of fluff. It just takes off, buckle up, and you're off.
Well, as I was reading it, I kept coming, oh, this must be where he got the idea. Oh, well, no, he could have gotten the idea with this. And so I was wondering if you even can put your finger on the genesis of the idea for this novel. You already have your interest in cemeteries. You're already familiar with the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery and the Old Dutch Church Cemetery. And I was wondering if you could pinpoint what was the motivation to start writing this book.
I just started thinking about words and how you know you can use words to evoke feelings and to describe things better, and that's how the book starts with just
because that's a prominent feature of this book.
Yes, I even have a glossary in the back, which you don't really find in novels.
And if no, that's true. You don't find them in novels, and in books where you do find a glossary, they're actually labeled as a glossary. I'd like for you to read what you call your glossary.
I called it. By the way, my storyteller's name is Chick Corbett. So it's Chick's Concise Compendium of Confounding and Complex but Catchy Colloquy Commencers, or subtitled, How to Sound Smarter Than You Really Are. And there are all these kind of wonderful words that kind of enhance your vocabulary. There's one in there called a petrichor. And we all know what it is, but we didn't know it had a name. And a friend of mine actually posted like 3 or 4 years ago on her Facebook page. She said, petrichor. And I went, what's that?
Well, most of us know petra. Okay, that's stone. And then you say it's from the Greek petra, stone. And you said it's the smell generated by the release of oils and bacteria from the earth when it rains in the desert after a long dry spell.
Yeah, but everybody knows that smell. I mean,
but we didn't know there was a word for it.
Yeah, and who knew there was a word? I also have a pogo nip, you know, and there's all sorts of wonderful words.
Words that are fun to say.
Yeah,
I love saying some of these words myself. You know, one thing that I was disappointed, there was a word that's archaic. And I'd love to use this word, but you say it's archaic. So if I were to use this word, who would understand besides you, Doug?
I do. I don't care.
Well, since I've mentioned it, I might as well say that the word, and it's fun to say, lubberwort.
Lubberwort. Yes, lubberwort.
Actually, W-R-T, most people do pronounce it like wart, but like our word, W-R-D.
Yeah.
So that's why I pronounce it lubberwort. Archaic from lubber, a big clumsy man. Doesn't the sounds in that word sound like a big clumsy man?
Yeah,
lubber.
Yeah, it does, exactly. And I also have another word that sounds opposite of what it's pulchritude.
And oh, no, I want to get back to that one because I want to finish with the lubberwort.
Okay.
This big clumsy man, lubberwort, an herb or medicinal plant. Food of little or no nutritional value. Junk food.
Right.
That's why this would be such a handy word.
Yeah, lubberwort.
But nobody would understand it because it's archaic.
Right. I see you're having lubberwort for lunch.
Yeah, I was too much of in a hurry to get something decent, so I just
got some lubberwort. Yeah.
But now you mentioned the word pulchritude. Is not one that was unfamiliar to me. Maybe it's because I studied Latin, but I thought pulchritude was a pretty common word. You don't think people?
No, they
don't. You
don't
think it's common? Oh, okay.
No, they don't. Well, I heard a couple people say it, and I didn't know what it was.
You didn't take Latin when you were in high school.
I did not take Latin. No, I did not.
Oh, okay.
And I said, what's that? And they said, well, possessing its beauty. possessing great beauty. But I said, well, that doesn't sound, you know, it does not sound like you wouldn't. There's a section in the book.
Where I know. That's what I just opened the book to that section.
Yeah.
Because you put the words in one of your character's mouth that must have been what how you reacted when you first heard Pulchritude.
Right. Yeah,
he's, that doesn't sound complimentary.
My character, Chick Corbett, is, well, he's modeled on me. You know, he's,
that's,
he's,
I suspected,
you know, you can
that.
Kind of figure yeah, that out. Yeah, and yeah. He's not real well educated. He's a nice guy, but he tries to improve himself. And he tries to kind of, let's say, seduce this woman, and he says, oh, you possess great pulchritude. And she takes offense because she doesn't know. She said, what are you? So I have all sorts of, there's a lot of wordplay within the book. But there's also a great story in the book, too.
So. My guest is Douglas Keister. His newest novel is the Sleepy Hollow Mystery, A Chick Corbett Yarn. We were talking about the use of words, and he has his main character compliment his girlfriend, said, looking at you, I have to admit, you possess plenty of pulchritude. And she's not sure how to take that, because what she says is, it doesn't sound like a good word. It sounds like something associated with a disease, you know, like putrid or pulmonary pus or maybe something to do with attitude. She winced. And yet, like I say, those of us who took Latin, we think, yeah, pulchritude, so.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to be described that way.
By the way, you did mention how I get kind of an idea. Mm-hmm. And the book starts off in the Limbo Mountains. And yes, I would say I first encountered the Limbo Mountains 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago. And I remember driving in Nevada, and there was a sign that said Limbo to the right. And that, well, this was actually 35 years ago. I almost can describe the day. And when you got to the Limbo sign, your cell phone cut out. And I said, I have to figure out a way to incorporate Limbo somewhere down. And this was long before I even started mm-hmm. writing novels. And so the book starts.
That's where it opens.
It opens in Limbo. and also the Limbo Mountains. There's also Purgatory Peak and it's all of these very, you know, kind of diabolical sounding places in Nevada.
Well, you also, when you open, you use this word for blue.
Right.
And I have to admit that that was a new word for me. But I thought, well, that's handy because we have all these shades of blue. It'd be nice to describe right. it. And what's this word for blue that people, other people?
Palatinate. Palatinate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book starts out very, very, just the first couple paragraphs. Palatinate, ? Yeah, palatinate. Maybe a hint of periwinkle near the horizon. Just a hint. Looks blue to me. That's your problem, chick. You're limiting yourself. You're all hunkered down in a psychic foxhole. Expand your horizons. Still looks blue to me. Uncle Ray and I were sitting on the tailgate of his rusty 1953 Ford pickup truck. We were perched on a granite outcropping high in the Limbo Mountains, about 100 miles north of Reno, Nevada. It was a home-on-the-range sort of day. There wasn't a cloud in the broad, blue, okay, palatinate sky.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and he has just read the opening paragraphs of his newest novel, The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, A Chick Corbett Yarn. And I like the fact that you could use the word story or tale, use the word yarn.
Yeah.
You're spinning a yarn here.
I it's kind of a Mark Twain thing. You know, I really admire the way he writes or wrote. And because it's yarns are the sort of thing, you know, your uncle tells you. And you're sitting around the pickle barrel or you're sitting around the campfire. And you're just spinning a yarn. And that's the sort of things I like to listen to. I mean, you know, Garrison Keillor, you know, he spins yarns. You know, he'll take an hour to get to the point of some little story, but he makes it interesting just
all along the way.
Yeah, the journey is really interesting. So that's what I like to do. I'm a storyteller. That's what I do.
Well, you know, when I'm reading your book and the main character's name Chick, and I keep wanting to say Chuck because Chuck is a name I'm familiar with. Chick is unfamiliar, and I was wondering if there's any reason you chose to name your protagonist Chick.
Yes, there is a very good reason. My father's nickname was Chick, And his real name was Carl, but his name was Chick. I never knew him was called that until much later. In the first book that I wrote in this series, I explained how Chick became Chick, because his real name in my books is Clarence Aldwin Corbett, which is not, you know, it's just...
Yeah, you don't want to be called all that.
Yeah, you know, all that. And this, he and his uncle in the book, Uncle Ray, tried to open up this fast food emporium selling chicken wings and gizzards and stuff. It was called Wings and Things. And it failed, but he did keep the name Chick. He got that's where he got his name.
In
Chick.
The story.
In
the
story.
That's where the name came from.
Yes.
And yeah, in fact, I noticed that fact, then I was thinking, oh, that's where the character gets the nickname Chick.
I also had a real Uncle Ray. That's one of the characters in the book. I had an Uncle Ray, and I thought he was the coolest guy in the world because he was a fishing guy. And I thought, what could be better? You know, you get up in the morning, you go fishing, and people pay you.
But I'll bet your Uncle Ray did not have a dog named Fido, who spelled the name in the French way.
Right.
French way.
Yes. Yeah. Phydeaux. And I have a number of words in the book that you, when you read them, you can't quite figure out what it is. And then when you start thinking about it, you know, you figure it out. But Fido's that's his name. Three-legged border collie.
A lot of people like to spell the name Fido for the dog in a Frenchified way, especially if it's a poodle.
Yes,
they get spelled that way.
Oh, he would never hang out with poodles.
Well, border collies are very intelligent dogs.
Oh yes.
And Fido has his role to play. He's somewhat of a hero in the book himself.
He is actually probably the hero in the book. You know, depending
he's
on how
the
you
one who.
It.
Well, we don't want to give away how, what he does. It helps solve the mystery. I notice other French you throw in there, like his Chick's girlfriend. Her last name is Depardieu.
Depardieu, yes.
And I think, okay, he's borrowing a name from a French actor there.
Right. And Desiree Depardieu, and it's alliterative, so it just kind of flows. And I have another character, je ne sais quoi.
Yes.
Who's just, there's something about him that's just, that people
hate. Je ne sais quoi.
Yeah.
You also have an architect named Boswell, who was trained in France, who designed, and you want to mention what Boswell designed? This is jumping over a little bit, but, we'll wait till we get to the cemeteries. So you have some French words thrown in there. They say bon appétit. People say that. And you have Bleu de France, French blue.
Yes, yeah. This is another way to say blue.
Another way to say blue.
Yeah.
Well, another word that it was funny was mubble fubbles.
Mubble fubbles. It's so
you can't say that with a straight face.
You can't, right. And mubble fubbles is a very archaic word for melancholy or, you know, kind of mild depression. And I say, well, as soon as you say that I have the mubble fubbles, you kind of, it's like a cure.
It pulls you out of it.
It kind of takes you right out of it.
The cure for mubble fubbles
is to say it.
Just say the word mubble fubble. Well, you have your characters eventually make their way to the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery.
Right.
And one of your characters said, oh, you should read this book called Stories in Stone, New York.
Yes.
And you don't say the character does not say the name of the author of Stories in Stone, New York.
Right. I just thought that was maybe a little too much of a push.
Too much self-promotion.
Right,
you do stop at that point.
Yes,
you
don't. I do. I'm pretty shameless, but I do have a line.
Selfless shame promotion.
Right.
Well, so you have in this novel, you quote from your book, Stories in Stone, New York. Also, you mention one of your books, Forever Cemetery in L.A. But there's a lot of information about the cemeteries that you quote from your earlier books. So that saved you some research.
Right,
you
does.
Opened
it's
one of
kind
your
of
books.
Kind of repurpose the information. But you know, it's kind of like some people will write books and they'll have recipes in them. I mean, it's kind of a thing. And so if, you know, somebody reads this, if you want to skip over that part and go back to it later, it's fine because, you know, it's kind of put in there to just give it a little more texture and a little more interest. Just another, you know, kind of another literary device.
And it does have interesting facts in there. Describe, for example, the history of the Sleepy Hollow, for example, itself. Who are some of the people that might be recognizable, names that people might recognize when they...
Certainly Washington Irving, who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Rockefeller, some of the Rockefellers are there. Rockefellers also have their own cemetery next to Sleepy Hollow, which is a private cemetery, but that also figures prominently in the book.
Well, now, you mentioned Washington Irving being buried there, but the two cemeteries, the Sleepy Hollow and the Old Dutch Church yard.
He's in Sleepy Hollow. He's just, it's only, his grave is maybe 20 feet from the Old Dutch Church. And also one of the main characters in Washington Irving's book, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Katrina Van Tessel, who was Ichabod Crane's love interest, is buried in the Old Dutch Churchyard. Also in Sleepy Hollow is Carnegie. I mean, a lot of people know that name. Leona Helmsley and Harry Helmsley.
Why don't you mention a little bit about Leona Helmsley?
Well, Leona Helmsley was called the Queen of Mean, people didn't know that. She actually, they had a mausoleum in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, which is about 20, 30 miles from Sleepy Hollow. And the cemetery actually built a community mausoleum right across from the Helmsley Mausoleum, and she sued the cemetery because spoiled her view.
Yes, that always starts as odd. So she's in the ground, but she wants a view.
She wants a view. So she, before she actually died, of course, she moved out. And she sued the cemetery. They settled it. This is a story which I think I can tell, which is she actually went to Sleepy Hollow, and they were showing her around plots that are available for a mausoleum, not just a grave, a mausoleum. And they got to this one spot, and she looked around, and she said, "Well, I can't see any other graves from this this plot, this area here." And the cemetery superintendent said, "Yes, you can't see any others." She said, "Great." So she and Harry and their dog, perhaps, are in that mausoleum that you can't see any other graves from it.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and his newest novel is The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, A Chick Corbett Yarn. You mentioned that Washington Irving is buried there, and I have a particular interest in Washington Irving because some years ago I was familiar with a work where Washington Irving kind of lifted some passages from a Spanish writer, a little-known Spanish writer, and then you mentioned in your book that Washington Irving was minister to Spain.
Right, right.
And there was a 17th-century writer in Spain. He wrote The Civil Wars of Granada, and that was Ginés Pérez de Hita, and most people haven't heard of him, so if Washington Irving is lifting a few paragraphs, who's going to care? So Washington Irving is more famous for his Sleepy Hollow writing, but he also wrote a chronicle of the conquest of Granada. And so that was of particular interest to me, just because of being familiar with this previous work of comparative literature, comparing Washington Irving other.
One of the other things that I should mention is that you asked me again, where I get my ideas. When I was in Sleepy Hollow giving a tour a while back, I found out that what's called the receiving tomb there was used as the mausoleum of Barnabas Collins in the movie Dark Shadows, which a lot of people are familiar with. When I heard that, teenage girls would run home to watch this soap opera about vampires and werewolves.
This is all new to me, this Dark Shadows series.
Oh, it was a thing.
And it plays a prominent role in your novel.
It does. And when cemetery superintendent told me that, and they actually opened it up during tours, and I got inside of it. But I said, well, I gotta work that in. And so I did. So I worked the whole Dark Shadows thing in. And the character in the soap opera Dark Shadows is Barnabas Collins, and I have my character is Artemis Collins, A.K.A. Arterial Artie. who's a vampire wannabe.
Yeah, and that's where he gets the arterial in his nickname.
Yes.
So this is one of the characters in this book.
Sleepy Hollow Mystery.
The Sleepy Hollow Mystery.
And there is also this, the Rockefeller Cemetery is, without giving too much away, the Rockefeller Cemetery is next to Sleepy Hollow. It's a private cemetery, but Michael Rockefeller, who died in New Guinea, perhaps eaten by cannibals.
In fact, I remember this.
Yes.
When I read it in your book, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
They didn't really know what happened to him.
Well, there's been books written about what may have happened to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, some of the sections in your book, I guess I'm squeamish about, which tastes better, the heart or the brain.
Yeah.
The men got the heart and the women get the leftover.
They got the brain. Mm-hmm. This is all true.
Well, this brings up another point, the fact that I'm not really crazy about talking about cannibalism. And then in your book, when one of the characters wants to change the conversation, he says something like, "Lovely weather we're having."
Yes.
And I have a friend who does that. If the conversation keeps going on and for whatever reason he wants to change the conversation, "Oh, lovely weather we're having today."
Yeah, well, my friend, my character Chick, he's a little squeamish, but his girlfriend Desiree, she's not. She's an FBI profiler, and she finds the whole cannibal thing fascinating, but what you're feeling.
Yes.
But she's just, she's, clinical. She's like a, somebody that's a medical examiner, and they just, it's their job. But, most everybody else gets a little squeamish.
Well, I was wondering if you use that technique yourself, if you want to change the topic, a conversation changer if you bring in a comment on the weather.
Right, yes.
You do that yourself.
Well, I am from Nebraska. We'll talk about the
weather. Oh, yes.
We'll on a dime. You call up anybody in Nebraska, they'll talk about the weather.
Well, you also use your knowledge of photography in this book. You refer to, I think it's his Uncle Ray, who refers to Chick's camera as a fancy pants camera.
Right.
So do you have a fancy pants camera?
I do have I have a number of fancy pants cameras. But I pull in, once again, you write about what you know. And I know about Sleepy Hollow and I know about cemeteries. I know about cameras. I'm not real big on cannibalism, but I did some research. And there really isn't that much there's just enough. At some point, you do have to describe, the fate of Michael Rockefeller. I mean, there's no way to get around it. And when I write, I just start spinning this stuff off. I don't really.
And yet, all these threads of the plot kind of interweave, and you come out with this mystery story.
Yeah, and it'll lead to the next one.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's going to be a next one, Doug. You did take about a 3-year hiatus, no, between writing. But otherwise, you come out with about a book a month.
Yeah.
a book a year, maybe.
A book a year, about that, yeah.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you about your new books, Doug. The one we talked about the first half hour, Storybook Style, America's Whimsical Homes of the 1920s. And the one we've just been talking about, the novel, The Sleepy Hollow Mystery, a Chick Corbett yarn. And you have written so many books that I've invited you back numerous times. And I might want to thank you in particular to be here on the 10th anniversary show of Nancy's Bookshelf.
Wonderful to be honored to do that.
Well, thank you for all your visits, and we'll look forward to more.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.